Marriage, the outcome of two love-struck individuals, right? Stop right there. Not always. I'm Bill Anderson. Today on Central Standard, 250 years of marriage in Western culture. Modern society puts love at the center of what will lead a couple to the altar. Past societies deemed love as an unreliable, even illegitimate emotion. Marriage was based on political and economic advantage. The church and state didn't always play pivotal roles, and the societal ground rules for marriage today would be considered outlandish by previous societies. We want to talk to you about marriage. Is yours different from your parents? Will your children experience a marriage that would seem foreign and peculiar to us? We'll take your calls and read your email. But first, the news from NPR. Quick question. How do you view marriage? If you're like most of us, your view is driven by dreamy thoughts of romance and love and pledges of until death do us part. But many of your ancestors had a completely different motivation for marriage. It might have been about establishing alliances, creating wealth, a strategic way of establishing power. In fact, 16th century writer Montaigne wrote that any man in love with his wife must be dull to the point that no one else would be interested. Oh my. I'm Bill Anderson. This is Central Standard. Today, 250 years of marital bliss in the Western world. Dr. Jennifer Frangos makes her living as an associate professor of English at UMKC. Jennifer, did I get it right?
You did.
In the 16th, 17th, and 18th century, it was more about economics and power. Talk about that.
In a lot of ways, yes. Especially at the level of the aristocracy, where there was land involved, there were titles, there was kind of family reputation and history.
Uh-huh.
Marriages tended to be more what we talk about as kinship alliances, meaning they'd be arranged by the families rather than by the people who would in fact be getting married.
And the emotion of love, it was kind of secondary. If they happened to fall in love, that was a good thing, but it wasn't necessary.
Right. You would hope that it would go that way. But at the time, marriage was a lifetime prospect, so there was no such thing as divorce. So it really was until death do we part.
Okay.
But among the working classes, where there wasn't as much at stake, there'd be no title, there wouldn't be much property, this sort of thing,
mm-hmm.
It was probably true that there was a lot more relationship, marriage contracts and things like this that were based on affection.
Well, you say that there was no divorce back then,
mm-hmm.
but there had to be options, ways to get out of a relationship,
out of
a marriage?
Yes. Formally, you could have the marriage dissolved. There were ecclesiastical courts and there were secular courts. An ecclesiastical court could nullify a marriage, and that would mean that the couple did not have to live together or share expenses, this sort of thing. But usually they were not allowed to marry again. So it would be what we talk about as a separation.
Okay.
You could also, if you had the resources, obtain an act of parliament to grant you a divorce. And this did not happen very often, but it was a known factor. It's also true that women could not sue for divorce until, I might have to ask one of my colleagues here, until the middle of the 19th century. Men were the ones who were granted divorces. And so it was usually in the case of a woman having an affair. So it was an offense against him. And so mm-hmm. he could sue the party she was having the affair with. That sort of thing. So there were those sort of formal arrangements. There were also plenty of informal arrangements where you set up separate households, this sort of thing. But because of the legal status of women at the time, any money that she earned, any money that she had, technically belonged to her husband. And if he wanted to show up and claim it, he could.
I see.
The children also belonged to him. And if he didn't ever want her to see them again, he could keep her from that. That sort of thing.
Dr. Jennifer Fegley is in the studio also. She's a professor of English language at UMKC. Good morning.
Good morning.
It's great to have you here.
Thank you for having me.
Basically, over the course of this hour, you're going to represent marriage in the 19th century.
That's right.
So characterize Western marriage in that time period, if you would.
Yes. Well, Jenny was already talking about how difficult it was to get a divorce, nearly impossible. Before the 1857 Matrimonial Causes Act, which was the act of parliament that allowed divorces in limited cases, there were only about four divorces a year in England. After that 1857 Act, divorces went up between around 250 to 300 a year, and then slowly each year increased. But it was still very difficult to obtain a divorce, even with the Divorce Act being in place, which allowed for an actual court in London that was completely devoted to divorce cases. And so the way that you would get a divorce, as Jenny already mentioned, would typically be a man bringing a divorce case against a woman for adultery. A woman could bring a case for divorce if her husband had committed adultery and deserted her for a period of 2 years, or if he committed adultery with a family member or a man or an animal. So,
oh my.
So there had to be a lot more, many more conditions by which a woman could bring a divorce case. And there were still remaining difficulties, as you mentioned, involving custody of children, because it was assumed that the man was the person who was in charge of the family and would have the financial means to take care of a child. So children would automatically go to the husband. So there were lots of reasons for women not to seek divorce, even once it was legal. It was also very expensive. So women in the working classes would typically, as you said, separate. And there were laws that would allow women to seek money from the husband that they separated from. But it was still very difficult to utilize the court system for the working classes. So many people in the working classes would just forego divorce and sometimes remarry illegally, or sometimes just live with a partner without actually officially being married.
So it was illegal to remarry?
Yes, it would be illegal to remarry unless you had an official divorce, which would be very expensive.
Okay. So, in the case of divorce, did one, and I would guess it would be the burden would be on the woman in that time period, would she maybe consider moving to a different location just so she can start over and have a clean slate, so to speak?
Absolutely. Especially yeah. among the working classes, they uh-huh. would be a lot more mobile, could easily move to another place. This was there were a lot of cases of sailors and other working men who would travel around and do jobs in various places who would presumably take up wives wherever they went and then leave them behind.
Really?
Yeah.
Would you say that generally speaking, though, people who were married in the 19th century, in the 18th century, 17th, and even back into the 16th century were happily married? Because it seems if the cornerstone isn't love, it seems like it could come unraveled so easily.
I guess my response to that would be that it would be just like today, that uh-huh. you were lucky if you were happy, that in the Victorian period anyway, the 1840s to the early 1900s, there began to be an assumption that you would not marry without some kind of love connection uh-huh. first and foremost. So the idea of that Stephanie Kuntz, a sociologist, talks about the companionate marriage was rising in the 19th century, so that while marriage was still based on social status and economic concerns, there was still the idea that those involved in the marriage itself would have some kind of, if not romance, at least an enduring affection for one another, which would be a reason beyond just economics or family connections that they would marry. So that's why sometimes you see the Victorian age characterized as the age of love and romance.
Okay. Dr. Jessica Hardy also joins us on the airwaves this morning. Dr. Hardy is an assistant professor of sociology at UMKC. It's nice to have you in the studio.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
Well, you'll represent the 20th century. So what makes that century unique or so distinct from what we've heard so far?
I think it sort of extended a trend towards this idea of companionate marriage. And I think one of the interesting question you asked about whether people were happy, it was sort of the rise of the importance of individualism that made that an important question.
Okay.
In some ways. And so I think people more and more were concerned with happiness in mm-hmm. marriage and individual happiness. The interesting thing about the 20th century is what we think of as sort of the ideal time for marriage now, it was the 50s and 60s, which were really sort of in a unique period of time. And this was a cohort of individuals who grew up in the Great Depression, who had a lot of economic problems when they were growing up, and then reached adulthood just as there was this economic boom. And so there were a lot of opportunities for employment. There were a lot of opportunities for buying houses. And they married very early. The age at marriage actually decreased and hit a low in the 1950s.
Mm-hmm.
And so there was this real sense of these perfect marriages. They lasted a long time, a large part of people's lives. Men went out to work. Women stayed home. It was very unique for that period and since then. And that sort of started to change very much as we went along. Divorces became more and more common until the 1990s.
Yeah. In fact, the 50s, I've read where it was described as the golden age of marriage, which I found a little bit perplexing, actually. Because, you know, women were resigned to a specific role. They didn't really have the independence that the man in the marriage enjoyed.
Yeah, I think it's golden age according to who, right?
So,
you know, it's certainly in terms of intact marriages and this idea of a mother staying home with children, but that's not necessarily ideal for mothers or even children necessarily.
And was that complicated by the number of women who had gone to work during World War II while the men were away fighting? And then when the men came home, they were expected to give up their jobs and go back to the house?
I think so. I mean, you know, for some of them, they never had gone out to work because some of them were mm-hmm. just coming of age
okay.
after that period.
Mm-hmm.
But definitely, I think it was one of those ideas that you can't really put it back in the box. So even mm-hmm. though many women stayed home, there were still many women working or who began to work more and more throughout the 50s and 60s as well.
Mm-hmm.
It's Central Standard on KCUR 89.3 FM. I'm Bill Anderson. We're talking about centuries of marriage in the Western world and how it has changed in huge ways. Our guest, all from UMKC, Dr. Jennifer Frangos, Associate Professor of English, Dr. Jennifer Fagley, Professor of English Language, and Dr. Jessica Hardy, an Assistant Professor of Sociology. Dr. Hardy, I want to ask you another question. You put a lot of research effort into economic hardship. Tell us how that hardship, you know, translates to courtship and marriage, and maybe compare that to someone who's more affluent.
Yeah. So today, there's two issues. One is that the more affluent are more likely to get married. So your income predicts your likelihood of getting married, and people who are poor typically they're less likely to get married. Often because they don't feel like they have the means in place to pay for a wedding.
Mm-hmm.
And they worry about their stability once they're married. And particularly women worry about men's jobs, that they worry that who would be their husband won't be able to help with the family, even if they both expect to work. Once people are in marriages or even in cohabiting relationships, economic hardship is associated with more conflict in those relationships, sometimes more abuse, sometimes just sort of unhappiness in those relationships.
I want to involve our audience in this. How is your marriage different from your parents? How about your kids? Can you imagine what marriage will have become by the time they tie the knot? 816-235-2888 is the phone number, 235-2888, our email address, at centralstandard@kcur.org. Now you're all going to be speaking. This show is inspired by a lecture series, and you're going to be participating in a lecture series, correct?
Yes.
In conjunction with a contemporary art exhibit called We Now Pronounce You, Redefining Marriage in the 21st Century?
That's right.
Yeah.
Yep.
Tell us briefly about that, one of you, if you would.
Well, it's a graduate student art history organization, and they're putting on an art exhibit in conjunction with these lectures that are all about marriage from the 18th century and before
century.
Until
yeah.
today. So yeah. this is we're all going to be speaking at various times during this this exhibition, which ran from Friday till mid-February.
And by the way, you can learn more on the Central Standard section of our website, kcur.org. Didn't mean to throw you a curveball like that. I apologize. So I want each of you, and Jenny, we'll start with you. I want each of you to briefly share with us what caused transformations or shifts in the dynamics and roles that marriage served in the various times over the past 250 years, just things that kind of jump out at you immediately.
Mm-hmm. Well, I would say one of the kind of milestones would be the 1753 Marriage Act passed by Parliament. Up until this point, we've been talking about the rise of companionate marriage. Jennifer mentioned the 19th century is sort of where that starts. Scholars in my field would claim that a little farther back. It might be that, as I mentioned earlier, among the working classes, there was a great prominence of marriage, marriages arranged on the basis of affection, whereas in the aristocracy, as I've already mentioned, you tended to see people marrying because it's good for the family or this sort of thing. So it may be that in the 19th century, in the middle of the 19th century, the aristocracy began to insist a little more on having some choice in who they were going to marry, and things at that level of society started to change. but in 1753, the Marriage Act was primarily passed because of concerns over heiresses being fraudulently married and robbed and dishonored and then abandoned. Mm. So I'm not sure if this was actually the case, but it was certainly a cultural fear that young, rich women were being seduced and talked into quickie marriages. They would, this is in England, they would run just across the line into Scotland to a place called Gretna Green, especially, where you could get a quick marriage, no questions asked.
The Las Vegas of its time.
The Las Vegas of its time, very much so. And once a couple was married, as we've already touched on, the man was effectively the only person in that marriage. So mm-hmm. the woman legally became subsumed, and any of her property or money or this sort of thing belonged to him. So the Gretna Green marriages were legal marriages, and they could not be dissolved, but they were not serving the purposes of the aristocracy because many young women were apparently being robbed and dishonored and then abandoned, and they could not marry again, and they had also lost the family honor and lost the family fortune. So in periods before this, there had been some vying for control over marriage back through the early medieval period. Does the family control it? Does the church control it and define it, or does the state control it and define it? And I would say that the 1753 Marriage Act was the moment in which marriage was sort of taken over by the state. And it's okay. a partnership between the state and the church, because
right.
part of the act defined a legal marriage as taking place in a church and being registered in a church parish. The banns had to be read. Consent had to be obtained if any of the parties were under 21, this sort of thing. But
and it had to be in the Church of England, correct? Or am I mistaken on that point?
There were other churches okay. in England at the time.
Okay.
So Catholic weddings were respected. But,
okay.
you know, for the most part, the aristocracy were members of the Church of England. And,
mm-hmm.
Right. So I think that Parliament was pretty much acting in conjunction with the Church of England to sort of define marriage in this way.
Let me interrupt one more time.
Go ahead.
Did the church and the state did they agree upon – were they motivated by the same things? Was it about was it about money? Was it about a sacrament? What was the case?
I think there were probably very different concerns being represented, although
okay.
they overlapped quite a bit.
Okay.
Some of it has to do with, I mean, part of defining a marriage is so that you can identify a valid marriage when troubles arise down the line.
Mm-hmm.
So that if, say, a husband has abandoned his wife, the family had some leverage to force that husband to come back and take care of her and her children,
mm-hmm.
this sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Or if a marriage was contracted that was not convenient to the family, if the conditions had not been met, they could declare it invalid and start again.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I think on the part of the church, there was a great deal of concern for your soul, marriage as a sacrament.
Mm-hmm.
In the early medieval church especially, sexuality was very threatening and sinful. And so even though the church officially recommended that people stay celibate, they recognized that was not realistic for everyone and so encouraged marriage in order to not sin
mm-hmm.
because of the kind of human carnal impulses.
Mm-hmm.
And then families, of course, want to have a say in, you know, who is marrying into their family,
right.
who kind of becomes a part of that extended family. And sometimes that has to do with maybe joining lands together. Adjacent lands could be united by a certain marriage or different kinds of affiliations, titles, an infusion of cash. You did see a lot of this in the 18th century as the aristocracy was land rich but cash poor, and there were a number of young women, especially from the Caribbean, who had money to bring in. They could marry into the aristocracy. Their families were satisfied because they now had titles. The landed families were satisfied because now they had some cash to spend, this sort of thing. I think it varies quite a bit.
That's Jenny Frangos. Jennifer Fegley, basically the same question.
Yes. Well, one thing that stands out to me is that by, after listening to Jenny talk for a bit here, is that by the mid-19th century, marriage is regulated, these laws are being standardized, and the ways in which you get married or have a legal bond are not so much the source of anxiety. Anxiety around marriage is surrounding actually the question of whether or not everyone is going to find a suitable marriage or a suitable partner. So the focus is on courtship rather than the marriage itself. And one thing that makes this very important in the mid-19th century is the 1850 census, which indicated that there were more marriageable women than men. So many men had gone off on colonial adventures to India, to Africa, to wars, various things, and that there was, especially in the middle classes, an overpopulation of women. So right about mid-century, you begin to see a kind of hysterical panic about how we're going to marry off all of the available women. And you also begin to see critiques of marriage and many women agitating for education, better education for women, and for other opportunities for women other than marriage, so to remain single. And you have a lot of anxiety about single women, old maids, as you would call them, or spinsters. So the ideas of the role that women are going to play in seeking spouses are beginning to change because women are beginning to take a more active role in courtship. Mm-hmm. So you're shifting from families being involved in arranging marriages to men sort of making the first move to, by about the 1860s and 70s, there's this entire idea of the very aggressive woman who is seeking a proper marriage because that is her primary outlet. And among the working classes, it would be a lot of people coming to the city to work in factories or various shops or to do other jobs in the city with the advent of industrialization. And these people would be separated from their family ties. So among the working classes, finding a partner that would allow you to have a sort of more of a sustainable lifestyle in the city, marrying became a way not only to have companionship, but to actually survive life in the city. So you begin to see actually women taking out personal ads in newspapers, which they called matrimonial advertisements, about the 1850s. And you begin to see, for example, Valentine's Day taking on a huge role as an annual event that everyone could participate in, from the working to the middle to the upper classes. And it was sort of like the day of courtship where you would find out who was interested in you or not. And both men and women would send valentines, which was seen as a kind of very forward act for women. And
And the Postal Service was affordable, right?
Absolutely.
So it was accessible to everyone.
Yes. Yeah. 1840, the Postal Service started to undergo reforms. So you had the penny stamp starting in 1840, the penny postal service. Prior to that, working classes didn't have access to postal communication because it was too expensive. And those who received postal deliveries had to pay rather than those who sent. So you have this shift where no longer is postal service cost determined by distance or weight or being charged to the person who receives it, but everyone can send a letter for a penny. So
okay.
It is while the 1950s in America might be the golden age of marriage, the 1850s in England is the golden age of the love letter or the Valentine.
Yeah. Dr. Hardy?
Okay. I'm going to be greedy and point to two things happening at the same time. One is this, you know, focus on increased equal rights. So for women, certainly civil rights, which broke down laws against marrying across the different races. Now same-sex marriage rights. I mean, just this explosion of this idea of civil rights for many different kinds of people. I think that which started mostly in the 60s and 70s, and then also the decline of the family wage. So you had many years ago Henry Ford insisting that people had to make enough in order to buy the products that he was selling. That stayed around for a long time, and men were able to earn enough to maintain families so that women could stay at home. But in the 1970s, as wages started to decline, there was this increase in really needing dual wage earners in all families in order to make life affordable. And so that also changed roles within the household.
Okay. 235-2888 is the phone number. That puts you in touch with us on the airwaves at KCUR. It's Central Standard, and I'm Bill Anderson. We received an email from Emily just a few minutes ago, and she brings up a point about people getting married in their late teens, early 20s versus marriage later in life. Back in the 17th, 18th centuries, I'm imagining people were getting married at a very young age. Am I right?
No.
Of course I'm not right.
I think we get ideas about that from things like Romeo and Juliet, right, where the main characters there are very young. I think they're 12, is this right? Maybe 14?
12 or 13. Yeah.
Right. So we have this idea that before our current age, everybody got married really, really young. But in fact, in the 18th century, the average age of marriage was about 25 for women and about 27 for men. And it had a lot more to do with being economically stable enough to be able to afford a family and a household. And most people put it off until they could do that.
Before we go to break, Dr. Fegley, you had something to add?
Yes. In the Victorian period, that average age actually rises. So for men, it goes up to about 28 to 30. And for women, it's more like 25, 26. Typically, a man was about 5 years older than a woman at marriage. And this is because he was going to establish himself financially and get his career going. And then marriage would be ready to go.
Well, how do you feel about this? How is your marriage different from your parents? How about your kids? What do you expect their marriage to look like? Phone the show, 816-235-2888. The email address is centralstandard@kcur.org. Marriage, how it's changed over the centuries, specifically in Western culture. I know I've had my eyes opened. Stay with us because I'm sure there are some surprises coming. This is Central Standard, and you're listening to it on KCUR and kcur.org. Glad to have you listening to Central Standard. I'm Bill Anderson. Over the past 250 years, the institution of marriage has changed dramatically from being more about money to being more about love, and perhaps about money at the same time. From less government involvement to more oversight by the government and the church, definition changes and attitudinal changes by the genders. And our guest this morning, Dr. Jennifer Frangos, Associate Professor of English, Dr. Jennifer Fegley, Professor of English Language, and Dr. Jessica Hardy, an Associate Professor of Sociology, all joining us on the campus of UMKC, all work for the University of Missouri, Kansas City. Let's talk a little bit about, and I think I'll go to you, Jenny Frangos, let's talk a little bit about same-sex marriage and how that's kind of changed the dynamic of what people view as marriage.
I'm not sure that my take on it would exactly support the way you just phrased it.
Yeah.
One of the things I think is interesting about the female husbands that I study is that they it's easy to look at figures like this and say that they are contributing to their self-oppression, trying to find their way into an institution that is designed to exclude them. Mm-hmm. And I'm not sure that that's necessarily the case. And I think it's a more interesting and certainly more charitable way to see them as claiming a space for themselves in the society that everybody else is living in.
Okay.
If that makes sense.
Build on that.
So it's not so much a lot of the same-sex marriage debate today has to do with how we define a marriage as between one man and one woman, right? And there's a great deal of pressure coming on things like that. That is a kind of a traditional definition of marriage, but I'm not sure it was ever codified in the way that we're seeing many states doing that now in the United States. There is evidence in a book by John Boswell of same-sex marriages back through the medieval period, sort of knowingly conducted by priests and celebrated by the church in different ways. But in the time period that I tend to look at, the 18th century, late 17th and early 18th centuries, we see a number of female husbands kind of coming to prominence, right, getting publicity, newspaper stories and things like this. And there were a number of reasons attributed to them. So, for example, there was a woman named Mary East who, with a female friend, decided that they were going to set up an inn together. They were going to be innkeepers. And they apparently drew straws, and Mary East, I guess, got the short straw and changed her name to James Howe.
Mm-hmm.
And the two of them went into business and ran an inn for quite some time. They were respected members of the community.
Now, what time period are we talking about here?
1830s.
Okay.
Sorry, 1730s.
Okay.
They were accepted in their community as a husband and wife, innkeepers, working class people, until a woman came along who knew Mary East as Mary East and started asking for blackmail money.
Oh.
And they paid the money as long as they could, but as you often see in blackmail cases, the demands became more and more expensive.
Yes.
And then the wife died, and James Howe was left to deal with this blackmailer alone. And when he could not pay, she could not pay, the blackmailer finally took things public. And upon that discovery that James Howe was actually Mary East, the wife's family became involved and brought a court case against James Howe, arguing that because this was not a legal marriage, James Howe should not be considered the widower,
mm-hmm.
and should not inherit what would have been the wife's share of the property, but that, in fact, should go to the family.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
So in this case, we see marriage as giving a same-sex couple access to kind of social stability, to a place of prominence in a community, to a means of livelihood that would not ordinarily have been available to two women living together.
What was the outcome of that legal battle? And was this kind of a landmark case for its time?
Not really.
Okay.
It's more of a sort of a like I don't think it's cited much as precedent in
okay.
terms of, you know, legal precedent and things like this. As I understand it, James Howe had to change her name again, moved away where nobody knew her. You know, she could escape the publicity, this sort of thing. And I believe she was financially ruined
okay.
by this.
Yeah. Dr. Hardy, do you have anything to add?
I think the interesting thing, and I may be incorrect, I don't know as much about before the 20th century, but a lot of the cases of, I think, early same-sex marriages or companionships often also involve gender in a way that's very different than today, in the sense that there used to be in many societies, you know, a third or fourth genders of men kind of being female and women being male, that they could then basically stand in for the opposite sex and maybe get married or have a relationship. Whereas today there's this idea that you can be a same-sex couple and not necessarily switch your gender, which I think is kind of a different way of thinking about it.
Well, we have a full bank of phone calls, so let's take a couple. And Leonard's joining us from Independence. Good morning, Leonard.
Good morning to you and our guests, the doctors. I'd like to talk about just briefly about the beginning of marriage, and that's going back into the biblical days. With Adam and Eve, the Bible starts with a marriage, and it ends with a marriage. And I think that's quite fascinating that God has a purpose, and under God's goals, it will be achieved in God's time through God's power, that whatever we think is correct is taken as correct, and whatever we think is right is taken as correct is right. But there is a standard, and I think God set that standard. If there is a God, and there is, and so do you have any comments about that?
I'll just throw out one thing. In the late 19th century, as I mentioned before, you begin to see a lot of critiques of marriage. And there were many women activists, including Barbara Bodichon, who were actually agitating for marriage to be divorced, if I can use that term, from religion and from the church, and
mm-hmm.
that there should be marital contracts in which men and women enter into a kind of business agreement. So as early as, you know, the mid to late 19th century, people were beginning to actually separate out church and marriage as two different things. So the idea would be that marriage contract could be dissolved in a way that didn't involve the government even as much as divorce did, divorce proceedings. So, yes, the relationship between religion and marriage is very much intertwined, of course, even till today. But there have been movements to separate those out.
I think it's interesting to note also that there are a lot of cultures that encourage married couples to have relationships outside of that marital bond. Anyone want to talk about that, comment on that?
I don't know enough about that.
Well, neither do I.
One thing I was going to mention before in relation to the same-sex couple discussion is there's a scholar named Sharon Marcus who has a book called Between Women. And one thing that she talks about in the 19th century is the ways in which amorous kind of loving relationships between women were actually encouraged as a kind of practice for marriage. For heterosexual marriage.
Uh-huh.
So she looks at the ways in which society actually and families actually sort of encouraged and did not look askance at very passionate or even very overtly affectionate relationships between women.
Uh-huh.
And that this was seen because men's and women's spheres were so separate in the 19th century, that this was seen as a way for women to sort of practice that kind of loving relationship. Of course, men could always go to prostitutes and various things like that. So for men, it was different. And I think that male same-sex relationships were seen as a lot more controversial than female same-sex relationships. But I don't think that people were thinking of these as lesbian relationships. They were thinking of them as affectionate, perhaps slightly sexualized relationships between women, but that those were actually healthy and in preparation for the proper heterosexual relationships that would come later. And there were many households with bachelors living together and many households with two women living together. The bachelors were sort of critiqued more because of the shortage of men, as it was perceived, and the need for men to marry and help these poor ladies out who couldn't do anything to support themselves. But the households that are known that were same-sex and run by women, they were just sort of eccentric old maids, and nobody really thought much about it.
Thanks for that phone call, Leonard. And Michael is joining us from Kansas City. Hi, Michael. You're on the air.
Thank you. As kind of a clergyman who does lots of weddings each year, it's amazing on how couples now are not going to the church for weddings. They're kind of foregoing the churches, and my experience is going to more civil ceremonies.
Mm-hmm.
And they really, it seems like they don't want to have anything to do with the church and the ceremony.
And Michael, as a clergyman, why do you think that is?
They've been brought up in the church. They just don't want to have any thing to do with the church. They don't like the traditions of the church, what the church is telling them, how they must live or things like that.
We can take this back and have a historical connection to the phenomenon that you're describing. Although, as the previous caller alluded to, marriage was sort of initially defined by the church. This would be the Catholic Church, or what we call the Catholic Church at the time. Especially among the working classes during the Renaissance, it does not seem that there was a real priority in a church service in terms of solidifying a marriage. You could make arrangements together. This would be about a man and a woman, or two different parties, exchanging a promise in the present tense, not saying, I will marry you at some point in the future, but I do marry you right now. So there was a promise from the party. There necessarily didn't need to be witnesses either. There was supposed to be a consummation, and then the proof of that was sometimes bloody sheets as a part of a wedding celebration, but very often the birth of a child a certain time later. And then that couple had to live in the community as married couples in that community live. And as long as those three criteria were present, that was a valid marriage, right? So on one level, back in the late medieval period, maybe the Renaissance, that church service was in fact optional. And there were ways. We have kind of a remnant of this in the common law marriage, right, which is something that sort of happens after a certain period of time and then becomes illegal status. And in many states, you actually have to dissolve a common law marriage the same way you have to dissolve a marriage that took place in a church as well.
Yeah.
In 1836, in England, the Civil Marriage Act was passed. So as early as 1836, couples could actually go to a registrar's office and get married, you know, much the same way we would today at a courthouse. And once this was passed, the numbers skyrocketed of people who would use this alternative resource for marriage. You could do it much more quickly than a church wedding. And there wasn't quite as much pre-wedding procedure that you would have to go through with the clergyman. So I think that the Civil Marriage Act really changed the way people thought about the connection between the church, the state, and marriage itself. So,
right.
Hey, thanks for...
It seems like they want the church wedding, but they'll have it in a venue someplace else.
Yeah. Thanks for the phone call, Michael.
Thank you.
Have a nice day. Marriage in the westernized world today. That's our conversation on Central Standard on KCUR. I'm Bill Anderson. Our guest, Dr. Jennifer Fegley, professor of English at UMKC. Dr. Jennifer Frangos, associate professor of English at UMKC. And also from UMKC, Dr. Jessica Hardy, an assistant professor of sociology. And back to the phone lines we go. And joining us from Lee's Summit is Roger.
Good morning.
Hey, Roger.
Well, you guys have really bitten off a chunk. You picked on a real subject. You know, the problem with it is that it takes so much time to deal with it totally.
Oh, yes.
It's unfortunate that there's not enough time on the radio to deal with it. But I would like to start off by saying that I believe in God, and I believe in the Bible. I believe that the Bible is the compilation of the wisdom of the ages. It's been gathered together for centuries, and it's still here, so it's kind of a testimony to its accuracy. But there are two places in the Bible that deal with the marriage of male with male. Romans 1:27 through 28, and Leviticus 18:22 and 20:13. And I'm going to read the last one there. Leviticus 20:13. If a man lies with a man as with a woman, they have committed an abomination, and they shall be put to death, and their blood is upon them. That's what the Bible says. And it says something similar to that in Romans. Now, whether you agree with it or not, that's up to each individual. However, I believe that we have to accept that somebody created us, and I believe that it was God that did create us, and I believe that we were created for a purpose. And what we've done is through our pseudo-intellectual self-acclimated, I don't know if the right word for that, but self-acclaimed, I guess is what I was trying to say, we have given ourselves credit for being a lot sharper than we really are. I think we're moving backwards when it comes to this male-male and male marriage thing, and we're destroying the fabric of the society itself.
Well, we respect your opinion on that, Roger. You know, we may have different viewpoints, but certainly appreciate you phoning in and sharing yours. 235-2888, and let's go back to the phone lines. And joining us is Hugh. Hugh's calling in from Bonner Springs. Hi, Hugh.
Hi. My concern is that our morals have slipped so in this country that we see the divorce rate as it is, and I'm wondering if people really knew what their relationship to God was concerning marriage and the effects that divorce has on people after the divorce transpires. And when we read in the scriptures that God created male and female, and then it says that for this cause man shall leave father and mother and shall be cleave to his wife, and they twain shall be one flesh. Wherefore they are no more twain but one flesh. What God hath joined together, let no man put asunder. And so this matter of being one flesh is a mysterious thing, but of course we just have to live a life with regard to God's what God says about it. And then when it comes to the divorce, this same passage of Scripture will go on and say that if a man or woman is divorced and then they marry another, they commit adultery, and both male and female. And so this matter of adultery is not a one-time thing. It's a continuous relationship, because in Romans, the 7th chapter, verse 3, it says that a woman that is not joined to her husband but to another, she will be known as an adulteress.
Well, thanks for your phone call, Hugh. You know, you'd have to argue that the consequences of divorce and a marriage coming apart cross generations, cross centuries of time, and it's always been that way, correct?
Yeah, I mean, in the 19th century, once the Matrimonial Causes Act was passed in 1857, many of these same concerns were expressed. In fact, some people argued that not only the Divorce Act, but the emphasis on companionate marriage or a marriage with love, within that idea that marriage would be love-based, is the root of the collapse of marriage itself.
Mm-hmm.
Because once marriage is not about the joining of families and the inheritance lines, but is about love, it's a much more precarious state.
And I think the last couple of calls have also addressed the fact, the very idea you organized this show around, which is that ideas about marriage have changed drastically in the history of the institution, certainly, but in the last 250 years, definitely.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, one thing that the last caller mentioned was divorce. Divorce really peaked in the 1990s. It's been slowly declining since then. There's a little bit of wavering, but it's actually not continuing to increase, which I think a lot of people are surprised by. You know, the other interesting thing is when we're seeing this rise in same-sex marriage, a lot of the arguments for it have been about economic rights and just sort of procedural things that make it easier for same-sex couples to stay together. And that sort of shifted the discussion of marriage from one that was even more about religion in the last few decades to one mm-hmm. that's become more and more about rights and taxes and just these sort of very ordinary day-to-day things.
Dr. Hardy, well, this is for anyone here. Would the world's great cultures and populations implode without the marriage ceremony?
Oh, that's interesting.
You're asking us to go on a limb here.
I know. I think that marriage has historically served a very important function. But would it now implode? I don't think so. I mean, you see certently in Scandinavia, just such an increase in long-term cohabitations where marriage just isn't as big of a part of adult life,
mm-hmm.
and they don't seem to be imploding. So I'm gonna say no on that one.
Dr. Fran Gose, anything you'd like to add to that?
I think there is an impulse to recognize relationships between people, and that marriage has served that. To solidify it, to make it a part of the community, this sort of thing. And I think something like that is probably very important. But as to marriage as traditionally defined or as we think of it today,
uh-huh.
I'm not sure.
Dr. Fegley?
Well, there was a Pew study a few years ago that shows that marriage is declining and that it is also very class and income-based, that those who are, more, as you mentioned before, Jessica, those who are more affluent are marrying more. And I think that it's good to remember that was also the case 150 years ago, that among the working classes, marriage was much more fluid thing, that many more people live together without being married, that this isn't a new phenomenon, that it's something that's happened for hundreds of years. And therefore, to my mind, it's not something to panic about. but it's just a change in attitude towards what's important. Is it that relationship, or is it a document that says that relationship is sanctioned by church or state?
Let's go back to the phones, and Vicki is joining us. Hello, Vicki.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. I'm Vicki, and I was calling to comment on the initial question, which is, how do we see marriage today being different from when we were younger, and I'm in my 60s. My observation, including with my own child, was that people live together until the baby comes, and then they feel the need to get married. And I think that might be because of economics, because suddenly you have health insurance issues and other benefits from work if the husband has a job. And before the babies come, there's not really a need economically to get married. And I've seen that with other friends' children also.
Yeah.
So that was just my observation.
Well, thanks for the phone call.
Yep.
When did prenuptials come into play? Any idea?
Among the aristocracy, they've been a very common part of marriage arrangements back through the Renaissance.
Okay.
It would be important if a woman was bringing a large dowry to specify how much she was bringing, to make provisions in case her husband died before she did, of what would happen to her. Would she have an income? Would she have a house? This sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not exactly a prenuptial agreement the way we think of it, because it was more part of the arrangements that were made on the occasion of this marriage. But they definitely have a lot of commonality with a prenup.
Dr. Frangos, what thoughts do you want to leave our audience with this morning?
Oh, boy, put me on the spot.
In 30 seconds or less.
I think, sort of as I said a few moments ago, I think the recognition of relationships between people is a very important social part of I don't know, there's a real interest in that. And as I said, I think marriage has been serving that need for most people, for many people, for quite a long time. And no matter what happens with the definition of marriage today, I would say as long as it continues to acknowledge and satisfy people, that's probably a good thing.
Jennifer?
I would just say there's nothing new under the sun. And if you think that marriage is transformed in unrecognizable ways today, people thought that in the past as well.
Yeah.
And everything that's happening now have roots in the past, and we need to look back to the past to remember that and to put it into perspective.
Dr. Hardy.
Here, here.
I like that. I would also say that I don't think that there's been such a dramatic retreat from marriage in the sense that people still often want to get married and say they want to get married, but the conditions aren't always there for them to do so. And so, you know, it's not so quite so drastic as people think, but there are changes.
Dr. Jennifer Frangos, Dr. Jennifer Fegley, Dr. Jessica Halliday Hardy, all thank you for being here this morning on Central Standard. And if you'd like to subscribe to our podcast and hear this conversation again or access any of our previous shows from the Central Standard page of KCUR.org, we invite you to do so. It'll be up this afternoon. Tune in tomorrow as we explore the life of William S. Burroughs. Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton. I'm Bill Anderson. This is KCUR.